into that in a minute. You're now using the whole secondary winding of 200 volts into the bridge rectifier, and now you'll get a raw voltage output of that rectifier of 200 volts instead of 100 volts. What's really happening on the first half of the cycle, where the upper lead of this 200 volt secondary winding, the upper lead is positive and the lower lead is negative. The bridge rectifier network, it's got four diodes inside, it will, on that half cycle, ground the lower half of the winding through one diode, because it's got negative voltage on it. The upper half of the winding with 200 volts on it is going to another diode, and it goes to the filter capacitor, and you're now charging at the 200 volt rate. On the other half cycle, where now the upper lead is negative and the lower lead is positive, two other diodes do the operation as to which one grounds the signal and which one that connects to the filter capacitor. So bridge rectification gives you twice the output voltage, but there's a catch. Because now each wire of that secondary winding of the transformer, let me drop. Because each wire of the secondary winding is being used alternately when you are using full wave bridge rectification by center tap grounded. When you center tap grounding using two diodes for a full wave rectifier, at each instant of time you're using only the upper half winding or the lower half of the winding. Therefore the windings get a chance to rest in between each half cycle, and you can draw almost twice as much current out of a center tap full wave rectification network. When you go to the non-center tap used bridge rectifier, every one of those turns of that winding is used on each half cycle. Therefore, the winding never gets a chance to rest, so to speak, and the total current output of a bridge rectifier is in the vicinity of one half if you're being conservative and you don't want to overheat that winding. So the good news about a bridge rectifier is that you get twice the output voltage, but close to half the output current capability if you don't want to overheat that transformer. It pays you money, it takes your choice. Now, when you're using bridge rectification, using all the whole winding at once, the secondary, the center tap of that transformer does some funny things. And if you're willing to put a filter choke on the center tap connection into a second filter capacitor, you can simultaneously be getting half voltage output and full voltage output. You can get twice the voltage output by the bridge rectifier into the first capacitor, a choke being operated on the second, on the center tap of the transformer going into a second filter capacitor will give you half voltage. So you can build with one transformer two output voltages simultaneously that are all full wave rectified if you use that network. Not many people know about that. Here we go. KC2WGB.
Very good description, Dick. I'm sure he's got that solid. Also, you might want to mention the ripple current on a bridge compared to a full wave. Maybe you want to run that by me.
Full wave rectification with center tap grounded gives you a lot lower ripple than you would with half wave. If I only had a single winding, just two leads coming out of the transformer, and I ground one and put one through a diode into my filter capacitor, so-called half-wave rectification, which means the positive half cycle is giving me the rectification action to recharge my filter capacitor. The other half of the 60-cycle voltage is doing nothing. So there's great big time-domain gaps, and therefore the equivalent ripple on half-wave rectification is huge by comparison to full-wave rectification. When you have a center tap transformer, or, and you're using a full-wave rectification with two diodes, or when you're using a full bridge rectification out of the full winding, in either case, you're getting a bump, so to speak, of rectified voltage output going into your filter capacitor on each half. So the amount of ripple percentage, full-wave rectification and bridge rectification, the percentage of ripple is the same. It's only the half-wave rectification that gives you very, very little ripple. It gives you a whole lot of ripple. If you want the ripple going into the filter capacitors to be smaller yet, Then the next stage of improvement is to use a three-phase transformer. Three-phase transformer being hooked up as a full-wave rectifier, all three phases, can give you much, much smaller ripple. And if you go the next step beyond that, let me drop. In the case of the very high voltage power supplies that are used on traveling wave tube amplifiers, that very elaborate power supply has not one transformer feeding the filter network, but two separate transformers, and each transformer is a three-phase transformer, and you're using three-phase power from Con Ed or Loco to feed the darn thing. The two separate transformers are wired in two different ways. One has so-called delta wiring, the other one has Y wiring, Y and delta wiring. And the magic of Y and delta is that you get another 30 degrees of phase shift. Your three phases of three-phase power are 120 degrees apart, and now with the Y and delta, you get another 30 degree shift on that. Therefore, you can have a full-wave, three-phase, two-transformer rectifier network that even before you use the filter capacitor, the ripple out of that power supply is down to something like 8%, as I remember the number, 8 or 10%, a very small number. Therefore, it requires very little filter capacitor on that kind of a network. But again, you pay some extra money now for two separate transformers to feed this very elaborate power supply. When you go to the ITT handbook, let me drop. I think the Frank Jones handbook, no, not Frank Jones, the Bill Orr. The Bill Orr handbook and also the ITT handbook. ITT handbook is reference data for radio and computer engineers, I think. The ITT handbook has a section on rectifiers and filter power supplies and ripple calculations with nice diagrams. I think there is a section on the radio amateur's handbook that talks about power supplies and rectifiers, where they show you diagrams of how to hook them up, and they show you diagrams of what the ripple out of the rectifier looks like before it gets smoothed by your filter and capacitor. Again, if you Google those particular words, power supply, rectifier, ripple calculation, you Google those words, you'll eventually find a whole lot of articles with diagrams that'll make it a lot clearer. And lots of ham radio operators think that a power supply is a boring subject. It really isn't. That's where the rubber meets the road. When it comes to airborne electronics, when it comes to your ham radio electronics, if you don't have a reliable power supply, you're almost wasting your time, if you know what I mean. Your transmitter can be gold-plated, your receiver can be platinum-plated, your antennas can be perfect, and if your power supply is not there, you're not on the air. So putting effort into power supply protection, current limiting, fold-back current limiting, crowbar circuits added to it, whatever, there's a large number of things you can do to a power supply to make it lower in ripple, purer in output, smaller in noise, more reliable, self-protected from spikes, voltage interruptions, and whatever. The subject of power supplies is a very important subject, and there are some very good electronic engineers who have spent their career studying the best ways of building power supplies for reliable electronics. And so to gather some of that information, to make an investment in the education in that area, can be very worthwhile. Without the power supply, you ain't there, radio-wise, if you know what I mean. KC2WGB, KC2RIW in the TechNet.
Very good, KC2WGB. Well, Dick, that's why you mentioned a good thing there. The three-phase rectifiers that were used in make-to-pick amplifiers were exactly for that purpose. Very low ripple and wonderful control with that. And it's heavily in the industry in magnetic amplifiers. So that's a good thing, and it's a good thing to study. And I'm sure this young gentleman's going to have fun reading about it. Some good sources, resources there. All right, let me let it drop. I'll go on to the next one.
You sound very good, John. You could use a little bit more volume of your rodeo. KC2WGB. K2LIW.
Okay, I'll get a little closer. This is what I was explaining to you the other night. All right. I have a gentleman who's working with 3 gigahertz, and he wants to know what size waveguide can he use for 3 gig. He knows that 90 is not going to work. So is there a letter or number of the waveguide for 3 gig? Do you know?
Is there a number or a letter for the waveguide? Absolutely. The U.S. standard, WR-90, for instance, waveguide, really means that is 9/10 of an inch. The first two digits after the WR, WR stands for waveguide rectangular, and the 0.90 is called WR-90. WR-75, for instance, would be 0.75 inches. Are there bigger pieces of waveguide? Oh, boy, there's a zillion of them. When you go to the reference data for radio engineers and you look at the section on transmission lines and you go through the coax section and then you go a little bit further and you go to the waveguide section, you'll see a great big spreadsheet of all the available waveguides. Also, if you Google, if you go to the website, again, of Tom Williams, WA1MBA, Whiskey Alpha 1, Mike Bravo Alpha .org, and you go to his so-called microwave website page, and there is a thing you can click on for transmission lines and connectors. But the transmission line section, transmission lines and connectors, done by K2RIW and WA1MBA, you'll see a zillion pieces of waveguides listed where the cutoff frequencies, the upper and lower cutoff frequencies for all the waveguides are listed, their physical sizes are listed, the insertion loss per 100 feet at the operating frequencies are listed. So lots and lots of information. The smallest piece of waveguide you can get is WR03. That's used for something like 120 gigahertz. And there are pieces of waveguide that work all the way down to roughly half a gigahertz, roughly 500 megacycles. Very rarely, except for a huge high-power radar, very rarely does anybody use waveguide below 500 megacycles because of that half wavelength of width minimum requirement. It starts looking like a piece of air conditioner ductwork, if you know what I mean. And yes, you could homebrew the stuff. Let me drop. You could easily homebrew the stuff if you wanted to. In fact, one of the things that I have done is to look at the stuff in a hardware store, look at the house stuff around my house, and I suddenly realized the aluminum downspout tubing that goes from the rain gutters on my house is a piece of waveguide. And I can tell you for a fact, I've talked to those microwaves, they are relatively blind. Does the rectangular waveguide have to be exactly square and flat on the sides and 90 degrees at the corners? Can it tolerate ripples and pinching in the middle and whatever, like double ridge waveguide? Absolutely. The waveguide itself can be round, elliptical, square, rectangular, and as long as you set up the dimensions correctly and the polarity of the signal correctly, the signal will go down there with very low loss. So there, I have, for a short period of time, used aluminum downspout tubing as waveguide at 2 gigahertz, as I remember. I had to squeeze it in the middle a little bit, not making it toward the double ridge waveguide in order to bring the cutoff frequency down low enough. I vaguely remember that the downspout tubing, I think the lowest frequency you can use is around 3 gigahertz. That gives you an idea. So waveguide for 3 gigahertz is going to be very close to the size that you see for aluminum downspout tubing that's used for your rain gutters. But that reference, if you simply Google the word transmission lines and insertion loss and waveguide transmission lines and insertion loss, you will pretty rapidly find the WA1MBA K2RIW website on that subject with this spreadsheet giving you all the information you want. KC2WGB, K2RIW in the TechNet.
KC2WGB. All right, his next question is, if he finds something that'll work with 3 gig, would he be able to use that for a higher frequency? What would be the limit? Could he go up to 10 gig with it? Yeah, that seems to be his whole question.
Now, now you're into a controversial area where I've got a lot of opinions, and I'll warn you, my opinions in this area, to a purist in the microwave world, will sound radical. Okay. Once you understand how a piece of waveguide works, the magic of waveguide is there is no semiconductor. At first you'll say, how in the world can I send a signal down there when there's only one outer conductor and no center conductor? Well, by the same token, how do I send a signal into free space? There ain't no conductor in free space. How do I radiate a real radio signal? And once you obey all the laws of physics, the signal will go through your piece of waveguide, it'll go through free space, and do so with very low loss when you do it correctly. However, when a signal is going down a piece of waveguide, good common sense would lead you to believe that the signal is going to go straight down the middle just like your eyesight does. Absolutely not. When you're using the piece of waveguide at its rated frequency, the signal goes down the waveguide by zigzagging back and forth. You know what happens when you walk into a barber shop that has mirrors on the left wall and mirrors on the right wall, and you look at those mirrors at a 45-degree angle, and you'll see a whole bunch of barber chairs in those mirrors, if you know what I mean. One of the barbers way down at the end of the aisle, you'll see him four times in a row in those mirrors because the signal is zigzagging back and forth. The light is zigzagging back across the barbershop when you look at that angle. Let me drop. Waveguide does exactly that. If I've got a piece of rectangular waveguide and I lay it on the table so that the broad wall is against the table, the narrow walls are now vertical. Believe it or not, that signal going down the waveguide is going to zigzag back and forth, bouncing off the narrow walls, not the broad walls, when you're using the main dominant mode, TE10 mode it's called. The signal zigzags back and forth between those walls, and for each individual frequency within the frequency region of the rating of the waveguide, there's an extremely exact angle at which that wavelength will zigzag back and forth down that waveguide. Because it's zigzagging back and forth, the signal coming out of the far end of the waveguide, even though it's propagating in air, and air has a velocity factor of 300 million meters per second, we call it a velocity factor of 100%, because the signal in a piece of waveguide is zigzagging back and forth, it is going through a longer path. Therefore, the signal coming out of the far end of the waveguide is delayed. It's got something, it'll look to you like it's got something like a 60% velocity factor because it's zigzagging, okay? If I go to higher and higher frequencies, let me drop. The other thing that's non-intuitive about waveguide is that if I go to the lowest frequency where it's going to cut off, just about to cut off and stop operating, the zigzagging becomes extremely exaggerated. The signal bounces back and forth between the walls at almost a perpendicular angle, where it's advancing very, very slowly. It's almost bouncing directly left and right and not doing anything, so to speak, when you're at the lower cutter frequency. As you go to higher and higher frequencies, the angle becomes closer and closer to parallel down the axis of the waveguide. If you go above the rated frequency, then that now is more than one way the signal can bounce down that guide. That's why people don't go there, because in the commercial world, if the signal can bounce down the waveguide because you're using it above its rated frequency, it can bounce down there by more than one way, to some degree it's going to do both. Therefore, at certain lengths, at certain frequencies, because the time delay of the signal with the two different angles of bounce, you're occasionally going to get a signal that's going to give you a suck out at certain frequencies, because bounce angle number one and bounce angle number two at the far end, 100 feet away, the two signals come out 180 degrees out of phase, and at that exact frequency, you've got a suck out. At some other frequency, they come out in phase, and you've got a beautiful increase in the signal, so to speak. If you're smart enough to know what you're doing, you can use waveguide at any frequency you want, DC to light, once you're above the cutoff frequency, so to speak. Will it work up there? Absolutely. Will it be low in loss? Absolutely. There's a whole company that sends you what's called overmoded waveguide. Let me drop it.
Thank you.
again. There's a company that will sell you overmoded waveguide, where it's called tall guide. In other words, ordinarily waveguide, when you lay it flat on the table, the broad wall is against the table, the narrow wall, the vertical walls are where the signal is bouncing, and there's almost always a 2-to-1 ratio in rectangular waveguide. The width is twice as wide as the height, so to speak. Okay? If you suddenly start making the waveguide taller, in other words, you're still using it in the exact same way, but the shorter dimension you start expanding it. It's called tall guide, and when you do that correctly, the insertion loss starts getting very low, and the frequency regions of where you can use it starts getting very wide. So waveguide will always work at higher frequencies than the radio. It doesn't suddenly stop working. You just have to accept the fact that it's got this multi-mode characteristic. In other words, the signal can bounce down there by more than one technique. And as such, you might get a suck out at certain frequencies. A smart ham radio operator will do a slight amount of adjustment of the waveguide length, width, put a tuning network in there. There's all kinds of ways that you can force the two separate modes to come out co-phase at the far reticular piece of transmission line. And so that's a whole area that has never been properly investigated, in my opinion. It's got a lot of potential benefit. And so it'll work like a charm if you know what you're doing. And even if it stops working, and you investigate why, and you start doing a little bit of a tuning network in there, there's something called mode killing. In other words, you can put a physical device inside the waveguide which favors one method of bounce versus the other method of bounce. The waveguide enthusiasts will say it's called a mode killer. In other words, you're stopping it from bouncing at one particular angle and allow it to bounce at another angle. So even though there's two potential ways that it can bounce, two separate modes, you can kill one of the modes and favor the other one. Or you can emphasize the two modes and get lower loss of the waveguide. All kinds of things you can do along those lines. Once you understand how it works, this is a controversial area that has been very poorly investigated, in my opinion. I'm a radical person for having these opinions. I'm a real radical person for having done this, and it works very well if you know what you're doing. And so he has anticipated a beautiful area that has not been properly researched, and boy, you get some fancy questions, John. KC2WGB, K2RIW in the TechNet.
I think I have a question.
And I just want to get one more question in on that thing. Does that increase group delay by increasing the frequency without changing the waveguide size?
Okay. Because there are two different ways of bounce, without a doubt, the two different methods of bouncing when you're using the waveguide at a higher frequency above the so-called upper cutoff, as they call it. Now, there's two different ways the signal can bounce, and if you go to a higher frequency, yes, there may be three different ways. Each of the ways bounce that it can bounce will have a different amount of group delay. I said group delay. A different amount, yeah, group delay is the right word. Let's call it a time delay. Let's call it the apparent velocity factor. So each individual bouncing mode, bouncing technique, bouncing angle will have a different amount of time delay, or what looks like velocity factor. And once you know the angle of the bounce, and you can calculate the zigzag path, and therefore you know how fast the signal is advancing on each individual bounce, you know exactly what apparent velocity factor, how much time you're going to get. Very deterministic, very predictable ahead of time. Once you understand it, there's no real magic there. It's not rocket science, if you know what I mean. Eric, I know you had a question along these lines. KE2EJ, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Yeah, K2RIW, K2EJ. Two things, actually. My original question was, what happens to the velocity factor if you change the gas that you put in, say, you use nitrogen instead of air? That's one question. But in my waveguide, I actually have these little tuning stubs that you adjust to minimize the group delay. And group delay to us, especially in the analog world, was very important because across the 6 megahertz that you'd be transmitting, when we're talking 6 megahertz, you know, waveguides got much wider bandwidth than that. You would actually tune these little individual tuners to bring the group delay into a minimum phase difference that you possibly create across the 6 megahertz that you're interested in. K2RAW, K2RAW.
Yeah, turns down the amount of group delay you get, it's very predictable. Without a doubt, as you take a piece of waveguide that's being used across its rated frequency region, and you go to the lowest so-called cutoff frequency, and slowly slide your tuner, your signal generator up to the highest frequency, and you make measurements, what's really happening, as you go up in frequency, the angle of the bounce becomes more and more shallow. The signal starts becoming closer and closer to going down the waveguide in a way that would be parallel to the main axis. As you go up in frequency, it does that. So all waveguide behaves in such a way that the higher frequency gets there first, the lower frequency gets there later, because it bounces at an angle closer to perpendicular, where it doesn't advance, if you know what I mean. Right at the cutoff frequency, it does that. The amount of group delay goes to infinity right at the lower cutoff frequency. So waveguide has got this variable time delay versus frequency characteristic. And so when you use just the right kind of a network with tuning stubs across a particular narrow frequency region, you can tune that out. But there's a catch. And the catch is the amount of tuning out you're doing is a function of the total length of the waveguide. In the case of coax cable, it doesn't behave that way. If I first set my broadcast station up on a 50-foot high tower, and now I got a second tower that's 100-foot high with a longer piece of waveguide, I have to do a hell of a lot more group delay, distortion, tuning of the longer piece of waveguide. So as you go up in frequency, it becomes more and more parallel to the major axis of the waveguide. Right at light frequencies, for the first time, you look down the waveguide, your eye is operating at 450 nanometers, so to speak. For that first time, the signal goes straight down the waveguide. When you're at an extremely high frequency, now the group delay goes to zero, the phase delay goes to zero, but almost nobody has the capability of using waveguide that way, but the amount of tuning required is a function of the length of the waveguide, and the amount of group delay is a function of the way the zigzag bounces work.
Oh, my God. K2LIW.
Inside the waveguide. Say, for example, instead of using air, I use nitrogen, I use helium.
Now, along those lines, Eric, I needed to use a particular piece of waveguide we had available to us, which had a cutoff frequency of 15 gigahertz, as I remember, and we had to use it at 12 gigahertz. Or maybe it was 25 gigs, and we had to use it at 20. We had to use it at a lower frequency than where it's rated. And so, if you look at the designs of waveguides of a particular size that go down to lower frequencies, once you realize that the voltage maximum on the waveguide is between the two broad walls, as if they are a great big capacitor. And if you bring those two walls together in the center by making it a double ridge waveguide, you move to a lower frequency. Okay. You can bring those two walls together in the center electronically or mechanically. What I had the guys do is to strip a piece of RG-8 coax cable, or was it the RG-58, not sure, take the Teflon, the polyethylene center insulator of the coax cable, take the insulator without the semiconductor wire, without the outer braid, and simply mechanically place it down the center of the waveguide. That lowered the cutoff frequency. I increased the amount of capacitance between the upper broad wall and the lower broad wall in the center. It brought the waveguide cutoff frequency down to where it can be used. So the dielectric constant of what you put in the waveguide and where you displace it, you can do the opposite if you want to. By putting the semiconductor of your coax cable, stuff it into the one of the 90-degree corners of the waveguide, you're changing the electrical characteristics of the waveguide, making it operate at a higher frequency. So put metal in there, you can move it up in frequency if it's in the corners. Put metal in the center, it's starting to become double ridge waveguide, it'll go to a lower frequency. Put dielectric material in the center, it'll go to a lower frequency. There's all kinds of things that we amateurs as tinkerers can do with waveguides once we stop becoming scared of this stuff because it looks so unusual at first. Once you understand the principle of operation, you'd be amazed what kinds of little doodads you could put in there as to change the frequency region, change the impedance of the stuff, change the cutoff frequencies, change what frequencies propagate through, change the velocity factors. You can have a lot of fun with waveguides. You ain't seen nothing yet, Eric. KE2EJ, K2RIW.
All right. K2RIW, KE2EJ. Yeah, in a 12 gig and 13 gig microwave, we've got some of those little doodads to do just that. Although, one of the things that I found most interesting is what we call flexible width. The fact that it's not really truly a smooth wall doesn't really seem to affect the operation of it. Have you ever played with that stuff?
Absolutely, Eric. And Rich, we'll get to you in a second. We hear you. We got some information for us. Flexible waveguide is done by accordion pleating the outer dimension of the waveguide. By accordion pleating it, you can have waveguide that can easily be bent around the corner, so to speak, or you can wave it back and forth in the wind if you want to. Good common sense would lead you to believe that if you want waveguide to be extremely low in loss, you're going to fill it with dry nitrogen, you're going to have the walls mirror smooth, silver plated, and yes, that does give you lower loss. When you start putting bumpiness in the walls, the loss goes up a little bit, but a hell of a lot more slowly than you think. The accordion pleating for a flexible waveguide works like a charm. You tend not to use 100 feet of the stuff. You only use a small amount when you're going around the corner. So the fact that the tiny little piece has got the 20% higher insertion loss is a minor problem. But by squeezing the walls down, you can adjust the impedance, vertically squeezing the walls down, horizontally squeezing the walls down, You can adjust the cutoff frequency. In fact, one of the things that we microwave guys at the 10X group, we called ourselves, and 10X stands for our version of 9X, or cell phone, so to speak, but we're on 10 gigs. We were building waveguide evanescent filters. There's a way you can take a piece of waveguide and put partitions in there and tuning screws, and you can make it a beautiful bandpass filter. However, a particular bandpass filter was operating a little bit too low in frequency. And what I did right in front of the guys, and it scared them, is I picked up a great big large C-clamp and started squeezing the piece of waveguide across the main dimension. In other words, you take the 9/10 of an inch dimension and start squeezing it down toward the 0.85, so to speak, by squeezing the waveguide in that dimension with a great big C-clamp, and all of a sudden the filter came right onto our frequency. And the guys in the room were looking at me saying, how did you know it would do that? KE2EJ, K2LI, sitting in the tech net. Go ahead, Eric.
Oh, that's very good. I can see that working. Actually, most people don't realize that the filters that we use in most of the microwave stuff is basically a piece of waveguide with a whole series of little screws that stick themselves into the waveguide. Actually, the type of flex that I was talking about is not like the Heliox, which is the ribbed copper. The type of flex that I was talking about really is a piece of rubber that's in a rectangular form, and then inside there are small little rectangles that sit right up against the rubber wall that don't really electrically connect to one another. You're to take an ohm meter from one end of the flexible stuff and connect it to the other end, and you'll find that it's electrically open.
Yeah, that doesn't surprise me, Eric. You and I could if we want to. In fact, I did this. We were doing a lot of experimenting on 10 gigs using 3/4 inch so-called copper tubing sold at Home Depot. You take the 3/4 inch copper water tubing used in your house, and you walk into Home Depot with a set of calipers, and one piece of copper tubing out of three will have a lot greater roundness, less run out. And so I go into the store with my calipers, and I'm measuring which ones I'm going to buy. I'm measuring the ones that have the leaf out and the run out, the ones that are most round. And the guy running the department says, oh, no, another one of these engineers doing a precision plumbing job in his house. And I said, I can't even tell you what I'm going to do with this, and it ain't plumbing. Okay. By using those pieces of round 3/4 inch waveguide, copper pipe as waveguide, you can also buy the coupling devices where the copper tubing telescopes into each other. And you could, if you want to, put a very thin sheet of Teflon in there in the telescoping so that the two outer walls are telescoped together but make absolutely no electrical contact. And that signal will flow down that junction, that telescoping section, with 0.001 insertion loss. Once you understand how waveguide works, it doesn't have to make perfect contact along every inch of the stuff. It couples in some very funny ways. That's what I think you're describing. There's a whole technique of building flexible waveguide where the overlapping pieces, the telescoping pieces, don't necessarily make contact. The advantage of doing that way is you're not developing galling and scratchy contacts later on. If you design it correctly with a Teflon sheeting in between there in just the right places, you can flex that piece of waveguide millions of times with no wear and tear, if you know what I mean. Rich, I know you wanted to say something. M2 Echo Oscar, K2RIW. Go ahead, Rich.
Did you copy him, Dick?
I'm hearing him very weakly on the input. He wasn't coming through the 8 machine on 2585. You want to repeat what he said, Eric? Go ahead.
No, I'll tell you what. Rich, go ahead. I'll make it so you can be heard.
Okay, Alex, thank you. A couple of minutes ago, Dick, when we had that jamming coming through, I don't have much of an antenna yet, but I just
thank you.
with difficulty.
I think he's giving us a report as to how strong the signal was. I know he's got a fairly simple antenna, as he said, and the guy running back and forth on the expressway or the Northern State Parkway or Southern State Parkway is essentially passing by your house, and I'm guessing you heard him on the input, Rich, and you're giving us a signal strength report. Anybody who heard things that shouldn't be there, please tell us what time you heard it, where you located if you were mobile, and what direction of arrival if you happen to have that ability, and report it to rfi@limehawk.org, and the RFI committee would be very happy to get your report. So the things you can do with waveguide are very large. The number of people who have been given instruction in their college that allows them to walk out of there understanding waveguide, I don't think one ham radio operator per 100 or one electrical engineer per 100 walks out of that college with the usual way of teaching how waveguide works, whistling that tune. A very brilliant guy who used to work at Bell Laboratories was the main instructor at the Pratt Institute when I and other and Howie went there, so to speak, and there are some other people I know who went there. I walked out of that class saying, microwave engineering is the most boring subject in the world. I will never work in that area. I walked out of that class and I said those words. I walked into a company called Airborne Instruments Laboratory, and I met a guy named Hank Keane, W2CTK, and he showed me what real waveguide work was like. I met him because I'm sitting at my desk and I'm hearing this zapping noise across the hall. I walk across the hall to the laboratory where Hank Keane was tuning up a 1 megawatt signal going through a piece of L-band waveguide, and because he was pushing the state-of-the-art of how much power he could put through that waveguide, it occasionally was arcing over and giving him a snapping sound. And I started asking him, "Hey, Hank, what are you doing? What's going on? Why is it behaving that way?" He recognized my enthusiasm. He recognized that I'm a fellow ham radio operator. He's a white-haired guy working in the waveguide rotary joint department for 20 solid years. He recognized my enthusiasm. He started talking to me, and the rest was history. He eventually taught me how strip line works, and a year later, out comes an article called the Parallel Kilowatt Strip Line Amplifier, using techniques that he taught me. So in the real world of waveguide, antennas, and microwaves, RF, what have you, it's extremely different than the way you're introduced to it in school. In school, you may think you're going to hate the subject. You get into the real world, you say, "Wow, why didn't they show it to me that way?" What do you think, Eric? KE2EJ, I number we could teach.
Dick, can I cut in for a minute?
You can teach that subject better. Who isn't the one to say something? Give me your call letters and name, K2RIW.
That's KTKMB, Dick.
Go right ahead, Rich.
We did try to give you some real-time reports here, but this guy now, at least in the last few minutes, is in the Hicksville, not as far north as my house, but it's in the Hicksville, Levittown area. His tendency is to head down the Wantagh Parkway, sometimes to the Southern State, back up to Seaford Oyster Bay Expressway. So again, I know it's difficult, but any of you that are out there in the cars, all looking for it at this point, don't go into a chase or anything, but this guy has an antenna, that's what you want to be looking for, and just kind of report that. See, if any cars that you find, just let us know, because to be honest with you, we're working with the police on this one. We will get this information out there. If a guy doesn't belong in an area, we will find him. But just understand, that's his modus operandi. He stays in the Hicksville, Jericho area. Maybe goes a little bit east, a little bit west, but that's basically where he is. All right, Dick, back to that. Send your reports to rfi@flymark.org, and we do appreciate it.
Okay, good luck with that, Rich. The way you're introduced to RF, microwaves, radio, wireless, antennas, transmission lines, transistors, amplifiers, operational amplifiers, the way you introduce to all of that in the popular American schools, in some cases is going to turn you off. Don't be discouraged. The real world is not like that. Start tinkering with it with those components in your laboratory, in your basement, in your backyard. Talk to other people who are doing it. Look at the real commercial world and the way it's done. It's very different than the way the schools are teaching you. The difference between the way the schools teach the subject and the way it's practiced in the real world is now becoming so divergent, and the schools are so non-responsive in this particular subject area. When it comes to computer science and engineering science, the good schools are upgrading that curriculum on that subject almost every single semester to keep it current. But the way we teach RF engineering and wireless engineering, the curriculum was set in 1947, right after the radiation laboratory set of books written, right after World War II, and the curriculum hasn't changed since. And there are 5,000 kinds of antennas out there. Antennas are not even mentioned in the course. So the fact that the course turns you off, don't allow that to discourage you. The real world is a hell of a lot more fun. That's why you're a ham radio operator. That's why you're trying the 26 different kinds of ham radio. I wonder if you've got any further waveguide questions, Eric. It's one of my favorite subjects. That and antennas. I jump up and down about what Hank Keane told me compared to what Professor Boyette told me. KE2EJ, K2RIW in the TechNet.
K2RIW, K2J. Very good, Dick. Yeah, I could go on and on, but probably should get back to the mailbag. And actually what we might do is give other folks an opportunity to get in there. Let's give it a shot and see what happens. K2RIW, K2J. K2RIW,
okay. Looks like we're coming through in the normal way. And so for the time being, we'll try this, and if he jams this, we'll go back to what we were just doing. As you can tell, that subject that you got from your mailbag, John, is a real good one. I didn't say it's easy. For a person who decides to start studying guides and things like that, I'm going to...
wattage and power, and they give him a weighted average And it also, he has seen that in information processing, dealing with weighted averages. And he was just trying to get a handle on what it is. He's been trying to Google that, and he has not found a good explanation at his level.
Yeah, I'm not going to think, I don't think this is going to be an easy one. If, for instance, I have a whole long list of numbers where I want to know the statistics of those numbers, I want to know the mean value, the average, the mode, the standard deviation, the first moment, the second moment, there's all kinds of statistics you can do with a list of numbers. Let's try to boil it down to something specific. I could, if I want to, measure the height of all the students in a class. How many feet and how many inches high is each individual student? And I put this on a great big list of numbers. And now I plot how often is somebody 5'2" high? How often is somebody 5'3" high? And I plot a probability distribution. And when you plot that, how high each one of those people are, and you make a graph out of it, where the vertical axis of the graph is height. The vertical axis is probability, how many students are that particular height, and the horizontal axis is height. And now you connect the dots, so to speak. If you have a large number of students in a great big class, a big lecture hall, like the main lecture hall at the Earth and Space Science Center at Stony Brook University, which has 300 seats. And if I took the height of each of the students in those 300 seats and I properly plotted it, I would get a Gaussian-shaped curve, large statistics Gaussian-shaped curve. And so somewhere on that curve would tell me what's the tallest student, what's the shortest student, what's the average student's height, what altitude has the most number of students with that height. And so once you get that Gaussian-shaped curve, I could now consider it a kind of a weighted average. It's a weighted average because the graph is telling me how many students are exactly 5'7" tall, how many students are 5'8" tall. Now, I could, if I want to, do a kind of random sampling. I don't want to spend the time, I don't want to spend the time measuring the altitude very carefully of all 300 students. They're not going to wait around long enough. They're going to be grumbling if I try to talk them into doing that. So I do some kind of a sampling function, and I find out that I'm not going to measure 300. I'm going to measure 30 of them. So in the process of measuring the 30, I rapidly find out that one particular altitude is very popular. Maybe it's 5'7". And I got a total of some number of students in the class. I know there's 300 students in the class, and of the random sampling I did, I came to the conclusion that 5.7 is the most frequent, and 6'4" is very infrequent, and 4'11" is very infrequent, so to speak. I then could do a kind of averaging process in which I make a phony chart. I know that there's going to be 10 times as many students at 5.7 as there is at 5.0, and as there are at 6.2, so to speak. I could make up a phony chart where I write down all of those numbers as if I had really measured those numbers, even though I did a random sampling, but I'm now trying to relate it to the real 300 class of students. I didn't say this is the right way to do it, but I'm saying this is one particular way of doing it. I am creating a weighted average. And if I know that that 10% of the students are 5 feet 7 inches tall, and I know that there's really 300 students there, and 10% of 300 students is 30 students, so I write down 5 feet 7 inches 30 times on my phony list, I'm creating a weighted average. There's a whole lot of ways that you can take a very small sample that if you do it with enough objectivity, with enough statistical smart, you can measure a very small percentage of a population and come to a fairly accurate assessment as to what's really going on. When it comes to voting records, when it comes to voting records, or when it comes to gathering data, how many people are watching ABC television right now versus CBS versus ABC. The real audience out there may be 60 million people. Are they going to call up 60 million people? No way. They're going to call up 60 people, and if they've done the right kind of cross-section selection of the people, enough of a random sample, they can get pretty accurate data, gathering 5% of the people or 2% of the people, and find out what the what the most likely population of those television watches are, or the most likely altitude distribution of people in that class. Now, when it comes to weighted average for a transistor, let me show you another example. Let's assume that your particular transistor is capable of dissipating 100 watts continuously. And I happen to have an application, let me drop. I have an application where I'm going to use the transistor for making pulses, and the pulses are only on the air 10% of the time. You could call it a 10% duty factor, a 10% weighting factor. This particular radar transmitter is only transmitting pulses 10% of the time. And my transistor is capable of dissipating 100 watts continuously. The next question is, if each individual pulse is only 10 microseconds long, and the pulses are there at a particular repetition rate, so that I'm only transmitting pulses 10% of the time, you might ask yourself the question, can I dissipate 150 watts on this transistor, which is only rated 100 watts? And in many cases, the answer is absolutely yes, if the weighting factor, if the duty factor is low enough. If you're doing it for a short enough period of time, and you're doing it with a low enough probability, so that all the dead time in between, the transistor gets a chance to cool off, in many cases, you can dissipate almost twice as many watts, if you do it briefly enough, compared to the steady-state rating of that transistor. That's a little more of the information. I'm not quite sure what the subject matter is, but weighting and averaging and duty factor assessment, there's all kinds of fancy things you can do with solid-state electronics, for instance, or when it comes to the amount of heating. My particular piece of coax cable maybe can only take a kilowatt. Let me drop. If I'm transmitting continuously, my piece of coax cable will just barely read a kilowatt without overheating. Can I put 2 kilowatts through it? Absolutely. As long as I do it with a low enough duty factor, a low enough weighting function, so to speak. There I'm using weighting function in the time domain, but maybe that helps a little bit. I'm not sure I've really answered this one, John. KC2WGB, K2RIW in the TechNet.
No, I think you did a good job, Dick. No, that was, I think that's sufficient. Sort of like the inverse of curving the mark at test time. But at least he has an idea of what the application of the weighting factors are and why it's used. I think that was all right. I think we should go over to Paul and let's hear the space report. Thank you, everybody, for joining the net. KC2WGB, back to you, Dick.
Very fine, John. I'm temporarily listening to the Eastern input, and it looks like the Eastern input is suffering quite a bit of grief right now. Oh, boy. He has chosen to jam the Eastern input, and that's the way that Paul gets through. Which input should you use, Paul? Let's give it an experiment. W.S. Turena, a space expert, do a brief transmission on whichever way you think you should, Paul. W.S.2N, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Dick, let me know if you want me to turn the Eastern input on. They can hear, but they can't talk the way things are.